I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello. Well, it's a real delight to sit with Francesca, who is the author of a really beautifully crafted group biography of five women living in Mecklenburg Square between the First World War and the end of the Second World War. There's the work of five biographies in it, all beautifully woven together. It's moving, it's judicious, it refuses to simplify some very complicated things. So it's really a pleasure to do this. And it's also very special to do this in Bloomsbury, isn't it? And at the time of year for street haunting, when you look in through the lighted windows and 7 o'clock, the curtains aren't quite yet drawn and we can see into people's lives and imagine what goes on within. And that's what your book helps us to do. So I suppose my first question really is what was it when you were square haunting through London? What was it about Mecklenburg Square in particular that seemed perhaps more compelling than any other square, or more compelling than Hampstead or Walthamstow?
Well, Mecklenburg Square is first I should say it's so nice to be here with you. I've admired your work for so long, and it's so nice to be in the other side because I come to this bookshop all the time. This is quite surreal. I seem to get lost every time I come to Bloomsbury and always finding new kind of corners of it, and it's sort of impossible, it's a labyrinth, and you're always coming across new blue plaques or new sort of churches or new squares that you don't know about. And Mecklenburg Square was one that I really didn't know about until I went in search of the blue plaque for HD, who I had studied at university and become very interested in the way that she rewrote the Greek myths, particularly her work on Helen of Troy. And I knew that she'd lived in Mecklenburg Square during this kind of strange period of the First World War, where she was translating Euripides and starting to work on these poems which took their voices from the heroines of Greek mythology, like Eurydice and Cassandra. And meanwhile, her husband, Richard Aldington, was away fighting in the war and coming home and having this affair with the upstairs lodger, and T.H. Lawrence had come to stay, and it was all a sort of nightmare. So I'd been interested in that period of her life, and I wanted to know and to see where it had taken place. But Mecklenburg Square is not really somewhere you just walk through by chance, because it's right out on the eastern edge of Bloomsbury. It's not really a thoroughfare. The garden is the only garden in Bloomsbury that is still locked to non-residents. I think after the Second World War, when lots of the railings were melted down for aeroplanes, and so then I think George Orwell campaigned to keep Bloomsbury Squares open, so a lot of them became kind of public gardens, but Mecklenburg Square, they just grew hedges. So it's not really somewhere that you go to sort of sit and have a sandwich. But when I did finally get there, I was kind of intrigued to see, even though the square looks very different to how it did then, there are just a few kind of pockets of corners, including the stretch where HD lived, where the buildings do look exactly as they were. So you can actually look up at the balcony, and in her novel Bid Me to Live, she describes the sort of blue curtains that led out onto the balcony. And there's a whole scene where she manages to leave the house and stands in the square kind of looking up at this room that she's just got out of.
Yeah. So I felt I knew the place well
that point.
So you'd imagined it all in advance.
I think so. But just anyway, just to finish, I then discovered how many other, I knew that Virginia Woolf had lived in the same square, and when I started researching and found out that other women, some who I'd heard of, others who I hadn't heard of, had lived in the same place, I started to wonder what it was, whether it was the square, whether it was Bloomsbury more widely, and whether there was some, whether it was just a total coincidence or whether there was something they might all have in common.
Can we just check the blue plaque situation? So when you were walking around, what does English Heritage tell you is going on in this square?
Well, not enough. I mean, it's got HD's dates are wrong, for a start. There isn't a blue plaque, so Eileen Power, for example. There wouldn't be one for Woolf because the place where she lived, number 37, was destroyed, and so where she lived is now part of Goodenough College. Although I've recently met someone from Goodenough College who has worked out exactly where in the house, in the current building, her room would have been, which formed the ending to my book, because they now leave a copy of A Room of One's Own for the student who takes that room.
I sense interviews with those students through the generations coming on.
Great biography.
Okay. So there's going to need to be some revision of the blue plaques after your book, I think. How did you go about choosing the five women that you've decided on? There's a brilliant footnote at the end of this
really
book.
Glad you've
I've totally read all the footnotes. And I was rewarded by the footnote that tells me about the women you didn't focus on. And of course, it threw into relief the women you did focus on and why you chose them. So just so that we've got your five in the room from the beginning of this conversation, just give us a tiny little snippet about each of these five women that you decided on and why you knew it had to be them.
Well, I think I knew, well, first of all, there are lots of interesting men who lived in the square as well, I guess, but I decided I wanted it to be women because I thought that there was an interesting kind of story to tell about Bloomsbury and about women who moved to a place, and that I thought that maybe what they were all looking for there was something to do with the kind of wider story of what women at that time who wanted to be writers were looking for, which was, you know, which was a room of one's own. It was a space where you could live in a different way. And quite soon I narrowed it down to deciding I wanted it to be writers because I thought it would be a way to tell a story about the way women have written and have been written about, which is, I guess, also the kind of thrust of A Room of One's Own. And so that did exclude some other really interesting people. Partly also, I guess, practically, writers leave more trace than non-writers because they tend to preserve their letters and tend to write diaries. And
Well, your writers seem to have burnt their letters.
So who
do you end up with? Just give us your five people.
HD, the Imagist poet. Then she was in Mecklenburg Square from 1916 to 1918, and she left in 1918 to move to Cornwall. And 2 years later, in 1920, her very room was taken over by Dorothy L. Sayers, who had just been in the first graduation ceremony at Oxford to include women, and she came to the square just knowing that she wanted to be a writer but without really having anything to show for herself yet. And she took on various freelance projects, but she just insisted that she didn't want to be a teacher, which was what most of her friends were doing. That was the sort of accepted profession for a sort of middle class educated graduate, but she knew that wasn't what she wanted to do. I guess I realised that all of them had come to the square at a sort of time of transition maybe in their lives, and for her it was the time when she was working out who she might be or wanted to be. And it's hard with hindsight, you know, when she persevered through this year and went on to write her first detective novel and is now so loved, and probably of all the people I write about, Dorothy Sayers is the one who people know about and love. But at this time, it was all totally uncertain. And the third chapter is on Jane Harrison, who was a generation older than the other women. She was born in 1850, and she went out to Cambridge in the 1870s with a reputation as being the cleverest woman in England. But that, in the 1870s, that didn't get you that far.
Well, it didn't get you a job, did it?
It didn't get you a job. This chapter was a difficult one to write, I guess, because she came to Mecklenburg Square right at the end of her life. She spent the vast part of her career kind of living quite precariously, going between kind of lectureships around the country, and it wasn't until she was 48 that she was invited back to Newnham College in Cambridge, where she wrote the books that really made her name. But in 1922, she kind of gave it all up and she decided she was going to reinvent herself totally, which is a pretty amazing thing to do when you're 75. And she left the university, which maybe we'll get on to, to why, went to Paris and ended up in Bloomsbury and ended her life living amongst a kind of coterie of Russian intellectuals.
Is it near the end, Francesca uses this phrase about thinking back through history, which can be quietly fortifying. And I think even just hearing that about Jane Harrison starting again in her 70s, I'm already feeling the quiet fortification of going back into these lives. All right, and we've got another scholar in here to talk about.
Yeah, the only one of these women who lived in the square for a long period is Eileen Power, who came in 1924 to take up a position at the London School of Economics, which was quite a new, quite radical, progressive university, which is co-educational. And she'd come from Cambridge, which is where Harrison had been, and I think was excited to join a faculty full of sort of radicals who were involved often in the Labour Party or in the kind of internationalist pacifist movement. And so she lived in the square until she died very young in 1940. And there is a blue plaque to her neighbour, R.H. Tawney. The two of them taught together at the LSE. They ran seminars and they invited their students back to their kitchens where they held sort of informal discussion groups to kind of chart the future of democratic socialism in England. So for her, they were a kind of an anti-Bloomsbury set in a way, or a different Bloomsbury to one of my final chapter, who is Virginia Woolf, who is sort of in a way the guiding spirit of the book, I think. And she lived in Mecklenburg Square just for 1 year, the last year of her life. She moved in the week that the Second World War was declared. And I think this year in her life is always, I mean, if we know that she died in March 1941, and I think often it's seen as the year before her suicide, and there's a temptation to look in the year for kind of foreshadowings of that. But I think just looking at this year as a kind of snapshot in isolation showed me how creative a year it was for her in lots of ways. And she was working on a novel between the acts. She was working on a memoir of her childhood. I think the war kind of raging around her really sent her back thinking over her own life, because she knew that, you know, death could come at any moment. And also the move to Mecklenburg Square for her, I think houses had always been very important to her. And this move that she did in 1904 from her family home in Kensington to Bloomsbury she always wrote about that again and again as this moment of liberation, the moment of her becoming a writer. And I think that house move is sort of a kind of emblem for the move that each of them were doing in the book.
And I love the sense of her reading back and thinking back through those other women in the square. Mm. But let's take what you say about Woolf's move from the high, dark, Victorian Kensington house to Gordon Square in 1904. And to her, this was this absolute hinge point into another way of living. And everything about your book made me think a lot about how those houses are arranged in ways which are different from the Victorian family home with its, you know, hierarchy of servants in the basement. Exactly.
Patriarch at the top. And La Virginia in her nursery could hear her father sort of thudding around upstairs, and she knew that she called it the brain of the house, and she
absolutely
upstairs room.
Absolutely. And then the nursery's at the top. And so clearly part of this appeal of Mecklenburg Square is that some of the houses are divided up into boarding houses, that you can just have one room. I was really struck actually by Jane Harrison's lecture in 1913, talking about how in the Victorian home, the drawing room is the woman's domain, but there's always somebody coming into the drawing room, whereas the man's study is inviolate.
Yeah, and there's never two chairs there, she said.
Brilliant. So Harrison had, before Woolf, really crystallised this sense of the woman needing the room of her own.
Yeah, it's amazing actually when you read that that lecture to see the themes which Wolf took up. And Wolf did know Harrison, and she invokes her as this kind of ghostly spirit at the beginning of A Room of One's Own. So it's tempting to note a bit of an echo there, which also is an interesting echo because they are, because she sort of speaks of Harrison in A Room of One's Own as an example of a woman intellectual who was able to write the kind of books that Wolf is saying we need more of, you know, books that write women back into history and look at areas of history that hadn't been kind of uncovered before. But I guess also she was an example to Wolf of how a woman could live a life or arrange a life, both kind of personally and also in the way that she, you know, arranged her home. And I think, you know, for both of them and for all of them, and I guess, you know, for the book, I was thinking a lot about A Room of One's Own and being, you know, being a literal, the way that you might arrange, even, you know, how you arrange the furniture can be important for
it's political. That's social history. Where are the chairs? What are you sitting
are the
on?
Chairs?
Oh, yeah. Of course, Wolf does that in the Leaning Tower. You know, where? Yeah. What angle do you get on the world from your chair? Mm. So, to me, your first chapter, which is HD, sets out in great detail, actually, what she does with that room. Mm. So I wonder, if since we've got this idea of the boarding house room, a new kind of living space with the chairs in different places, give us a little bit of a sense of how HD arranged her bedsit room, perhaps, and what worked about it, and then what rapidly became distressing to her about that setup. And I ask this with some emphasis because I feel so many of us have lived in bedsits and found them both liberating and also horrendously claustrophobic and on show, and all these seem very modern questions.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, I guess HD moved to Mecklenburg Square with her husband. And the way they kind of conceived their relationship from the very beginning was that it was going to be a kind of a marriage of equals. They were both poets. They wanted to live kind of in partnership and collaborate on poetry together. And they, neither of them wanted, you know, wanted hierarchy and so on. But I guess it was, HD had a stillbirth in 1915, which really deeply traumatized her. And she always associated it also very much with the war happening outside and bringing sort of death within her, and I think she always associated that with her husband, who she found somewhat sort of callous after it, and that was the moment of this sort of widening gulf between them, which deepened when he was going away to fight and then coming back and you know, was having this affair with this woman, this sort of very glamorous woman, Arabella York, who lived upstairs. And she writes so many novels about this period. She wrote it over and over again. And in each of the different novels, the house takes on this really important symbol as a kind of emblem of both of the relationship and also of her own sense of selfhood. She feels, I guess, very associated with the room and the house because that's her domain. She's left there when he's away and everything around her, you know, outside there's, you know, planes and gales of wind and inside the house it's all, everything is kind of in the wrong place. And eventually she does this sort of self-obliterating gesture and allows Aldington and Arabella to use the main room, and she kind of retreats upstairs to this sort of tiny attic. I think in Bloomsbury the houses sort of got, the rooms get smaller as you go further up, and they get sort of cheaper in the boarding houses. So at the top you just have a kind of a tiny, tiny room, which I think was, this one was converted from a bathroom. So that's sort of where she was.
Which is partly about not wanting to be seen. I mean, one feels very viscerally her horror of people, visitors to the room, being able to see her bed and her clothes.
Yeah, well, the way they had this one big room, which was divided by a kind of a screen, and so the bed was not really separated from the living area. And the bed, you know, was the sort of symbol of the dissolution of her marriage. And I think, whilst I think HD was very torn because I think she, you know, she wanted to live differently and experimentally, and in theory she was interested in, you know, in free love and in people not being possessive of each other. But I think in practice and the way that this was happening, she was, she was grappling seriously with what that might mean in practice and where that might leave her and her work. And she was, at this time, she was doing a lot of translation from Euripides, and she was focusing on the kind of female voices from the chorus who are kind of watching on powerless while war is, you know, engulfing everything and everyone that they've known and loved. And I think, it's an insight into the kind of unimaginable pressures of living at that period of history.
In a way, the whole method of your book emerges from that grappling that HD does over 40 years, she thinks, thinking back over that room. Because there's a sense in which you might open the book and look at the structure of it and think, well, some of these women only lived there for a year. But actually what's so subtle and take some thinking about in the book is the way that you show how you have to think about the whole life before in order to understand how someone lived in their room for that year, and then how that room or house affected all of life afterwards. And she shows that for HD, she's rethinking that one little slice of life over and over and over, even having established herself in a happy relationship, bringing up the child.
Yeah, definitely. She had analysis with Freud in the 30s and to sort of fortify her a bit for the next World War and to kind of address this period of writer's block she'd been suffering. And he told her that he thought that she needed to go back to this period in Mecklenburg Square because he could tell that something about it was kind of stopping her. And I think what ultimately came out was actually was a creative question. I think she'd written these novels. She started writing a novel about it as soon as she, I think even during, while she was in the square, and carried it on after she left. And through the 20s, she wrote several different versions which all take place in sort of different timelines. And some of them are very tightly focused on that square period, and others cover her childhood and go much further out. One of them set in a Roman army camp, and some of them are interesting because the marriage situation doesn't really come into it, and it's the sort of trauma is the loss of this early female lover and then the kind of meeting of Briar, her female partner, after that. And it's those relationships which are important. And then there are other ones which much more focus on the sort of heterosexual marriage. But she wanted all of those to be destroyed. She wrote Destroy on all of them, although they weren't. And in fact, was published most of them in the 70s and 80s. So you can read them and compare them, and it's fascinating and complicated. But the book, the version that she did publish in 1960, I think at its core is this other question, which is about her as an artist, and it centres on this sort of disagreement with this character who's very clearly D.H. Lawrence, who during the period in the square seems to have told her that a woman shouldn't try to write anything universal. She shouldn't try to take on a man's perspective. She should just write from what she knows. And HD ends the book with this incredibly powerful letter back where she's saying, in order to be whole and free, I need to live in two dimensions, which is a kind of allusion to something Aldington said to her when he was kind of grappling with his desire for her and also his desire for Arabella. And he said something like, I would give her a mind and I would give you a body. And she's, it's this question of, you know, which we still talk about, you know, how to be whole and multiple and, you know, how to be a woman and a writer and have those things not be incompatible. And that's something all of these women were grappling with. And HD is someone who addresses that very explicitly and very powerfully, I think. And, you know, much later in her life than the period that she was living there. But it did, this period set off for her these questions, which, and I guess, you know, setting up home and experimenting and living in a different way, even if it didn't bring her much happiness at the time, it did set off these questions which she asked throughout her life.
Following these women's minds, let's get to these, the two great academics in this book. In fact, these are my favourite chapters, were your chapters on Jane Harrison and Eileen Power, about whom I knew shamefully little, Eileen Power. And I've now ordered copies of Medieval People and Medieval Nunnery.
Good, so good.
Yes.
Really 700 pages, but surprisingly fun.
I'm totally up for it. But actually, Nunnery raises the subject that I want to ask you about, which is, you bring out a very fascinating comparison between the opportunity for these women to live in college. We'll talk in a minute about the fact they couldn't actually get jobs in colleges to start with. But let's think about, there's the model of academia with its cloisters and its servants and its dining halls and its circles of clever people. And then here's this other model of the square. And clearly both Harrison and Eileen Powell are very, very aware of those as models of how to live and choosing between them. How do you think the Bloomsbury Square offered them something different from the college?
Well, I think both of them, and Dorothy Sayers as well, I guess, or her character, Harriet Vane, grapple with that question of, yeah, of how to live and whether living in an institution or a community can offer you, you know, if you're in an institution, you don't have to worry about, you know, life admin. There are people who will, you know, help you with the cooking, cleaning. Your whole life is just devoted to
I miss
the
it so much. I just miss dinner being at 7:30.
And Harriet, in Dorothy Sayers' novel Gaudy Night, her character Harriet Vane, who lives at Mecklenburg Square, gets called back to her old Oxford college to address the situation with a poison pen. And she is kind of a cipher for Sayers, I guess, and she asks exactly that about, she's quite tempted by the academic life and she is sort of wondering whether to go back, but she's also asking this question which Sayers herself asked through her life and never really found the answer to in life, but sort of does in fiction, of whether it's better to kind of absent yourself from the world and live a kind of ivory tower existence, or whether it's possible to, you know, to live a kind of intellectual life, you know, within a family or within a relationship or within a community that's not of the university. And I think, I mean, Eileen Power and Jane Harrison are both academics who were sort of excluded, or, well, to some degree excluded or not made entirely welcome within institutions. I mean, Jane Harrison to more of an extreme, because she wasn't given jobs for years and was often told it was because she was a woman, and it wasn't until she was 48 she went back to Newnham on a fellowship specifically designed for former pupils.
The comparison between Harrison and which is her contemporary, who goes and immediately gets Gilbert Murray
23 with a salary,
so they're both graduating and the man goes and gets his professorship,
yeah, and spends the rest of his life, I guess, within the institution. I mean, Gilbert Murray does loads of amazing stuff outside it as well, but I think both Harrison and Power, who was working within an institution, the LSE, where she was, you know, largely considered an equal amongst the faculty, but there was always a gender pay gap, and she still faced not being taken seriously in lots of ways. But I think both of them, the reason maybe both of them were attracted to the square model as opposed to the nunnery model was, Power even says to a friend something like, the reason I had to leave Cambridge was that the study of English medieval nunneries, living in a Cambridge college and studying nunneries made it clear to me that I had to find a different way. But they both were, you know, thoroughly scholarly and thoroughly intellectual, but they also wanted to carve out a different way of living as a scholar, I think. And I think both of them, particularly Harrison, maybe thought, you know, if the institution isn't going to offer women degrees, for example, which she campaigned for Cambridge to do for years, and they didn't until 1948, both of them wanted to bring different people into their scholarship. I think Power did so much broadcasting to children, because she, in fact, didn't publish as much as, you know, most of her male contemporaries did, because so much of the work that she was doing through her life was collaborations and editing work and broadcasting and writing textbooks for schools, because she was an economic historian, and she started off her career by writing these amazing works of social history, which medieval people focuses on women and sort of working class people in medieval times. And she insisted that, you know, as Wolf says, that history shouldn't just be the biographies of great men, but actually, you know, the everyday lives and concerns of ordinary people could be and should be exactly what history addresses. And we're not going to see women as important in the present if we're not interested in their histories and what's been important to them through the years.
And you think of the legacy of that thinking, what started there and then with this new kind of economically focused social history, And then went on through Jane Thirsk and Margaret Spufford. Mm, yeah, and, really. You know, it's so rich and it's such a radical tradition still.
And I guess what happened after she moved to the LSE and she was quite involved with the League of Nations, and she kind of turned, as she could see, you know, how world politics was kind of combusting, she believed that her duty as a historian and as a scholar was to turn her history writing very much towards the present. And I think this was something that Tawney and Harold Laski and lots of the others at LSE were interested in. People like Toynbee, who was a good friend of hers, and H.G. Wells as well. She wanted to write world history, and she wanted it not just to be for other academics, she wanted it to be for the public, and particularly for children, because she could see that the way to prevent war happening in the future was to teach children not just British history in isolation, but to teach them about the whole world, you know, to teach them about China and India, and which were both places that she'd been to, and to give a sense that of history as a collaborative enterprise. And, you know, and she uses the phrase citizens of the world, as does Jane Harrison. Actually, it was quite eerie when I was doing the research and was reading these kind of manifestos for history, which were also their manifestos for the time they were living in, but also, you know, it could be a manifesto for the present.
Definitely.
Or for the future.
And they both couch their manifestos in terms of community, in teaching children history, you're allowing them to become part of a larger community than that formed by their immediate class or nation. And it's such a powerful sort of driver for education, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really politically motivated.
Yeah. And that was something I found interesting in writing. You know, the book starts off in Mecklenburg Square, but none of them were, you know, was insular in any way in their thinking. And, you know, Wolfe took up Eileen Power and Jane Harrison's work late at the end of her life when she was living in the square, and she was kind of facing quite a lot of accusations about her own sort of class hypocrisy, and she kind of took that seriously and took it to heart, and she could see that, you know, that in lots of ways Bloomsbury was, you know, open to accusations of elitism or whatever, and she, you know, was uncomfortable with it. And I think, you know, it's so interesting reading her diaries to see her really self-questioning and kind of grappling with her own position in a fast-changing world. And her final project, which she never completed, was going to be this amazing sort of history of English literature told through the character of a non, which reaches back to Room of One's Own, where she says so often, you know, a non has been a woman. And so she started reading history books which were going to help her to write this kind of alternative history of England. And she describes buying a packet of cigarettes and Eileen Power at a sort of newsstand. It's such a shame she never finished that book, because it would have changed, I think, the way that we think about Wolfe, probably.
So can you see Power's direct influence on the way Wolfe starts to think about history? Or is it just that they're both working in the same seam, I suppose, and shifting our sense away from politics, action, military history to where the chairs are, who's in the kitchen?
Yeah, Power talks about writing about the kitchens of history, and I think it's her sense of kind of what's important and what to look for, and her sense of history as being, you know, being fun and being social. And but I think it's probably Harrison's influence you see more maybe on the structure of what survives of what would have been a non, because she wrote a lot about ancient community and how she had this whole theory in this book, Ancient Art and Ritual, which I think Wolfe got for Christmas in 1923, which was all about how art and Greek tragedy and drama actually came out of this sort of ritual dance, which women worshippers would have done for the good of the wider community. And Jane Harrison's, I mean, the sort of thrust of her work was to look back beyond the kind of literary depictions of the Homeric gods as this kind of pantheon led by Zeus, the patriarch, heading an adulterous patriarch of a nuclear family. And she said that long before that was the accepted view of Greek religion, there was a worship focusing on mother goddesses, which was done in the community by groups of women. And so her work was really arguing that art came out of community, which I think was really kind of ripe and interesting for Wolf. And that was going to be sort of the starting point of her project, and kind of shows her own thinking about class, I guess, this idea of communality, which also is so inflected by the time she was living in the Second World War, when she was partly living in the square, partly living in the country, was feeling very divided between this sort of solitary life that she wanted, but also this sense of an impulse towards communal living, I think.
Yeah. Coming on to Wolf, I tend to think of that last period of her life as very much rooted in Rodmer. I was so struck by the fact that trying to get herself to sleep during an air raid in the Sussex countryside, what she uses to send herself to sleep is an idea of think of London, think of the Thames at London Bridge. And that sense that is what is sturdy somehow and will get her through the night seemed very, very potent to me. And made me sort of value more that experience of Mecklenburg Square that she had for such a short time.
I guess it was an odd period for her. She never really settled into that house. Mm. They didn't really want to move there. They were happy in Tavistock Square until this building works on this hotel just made it kind of impossible for her to get anything done. And she describes turning up and looking over their new house and thinking, which of these rooms am I going to die in?
Yeah.
And I guess the house move, was tied up with the war and with sort of inconvenience and with a sense of not being settled and then living between town and country. And she was asking again, perhaps a bit reluctantly, these questions about how she wanted to live until the square was bombed and the decision was made and she never lived in London again.
Do you think that today, when presumably we can't really afford to buy a house on Mecklenburg Square.
Last I checked, they were about £2 million. I did look over some. Nice estate agent showed them to me, and I think he was quite excited that maybe someone was going to buy sort of two of these houses. And I kept asking, "So is that original?" And he was sort of saying, "Don't worry, it's all been renovated." And I
we got rid of those nasty curtains.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, you'll be moving in next year then. I was wondering whether you feel sort of optimistic for people today being able to invent the kinds of domestic space, arrange the chairs in the way that they feel they need to. And do you think any of these women can still be role models for us today, arranging our rooms?
I don't know about arranging the rooms. I think the way they can be role models probably most is in the less literal side of the room of one's own and the way that they kind of arrange their lives. I think it was lots of the questions that they are asking are questions that we still ask and address. I think a lot of contemporary writing addresses similar questions, and I think talking to friends, we're asking the same the same questions about how to be taken seriously and how to arrange rooms. I don't think we've found a solution.
And that there's not one
housing prices aren't going to help.
Indeed. And there's not one question and one solution for when one's in the early 20s, just out of university. You give us two women who are in that situation, raring to go. But you also give us Eileen Power through her key middle-aged professional years, and you give us Jane Harrison in her 70s still wondering how can I live differently, how can it be better, how can I form a different community. I think that sort of stages of life that you give us is very moving, actually.
Yeah, well, that was something that was so fascinating about putting together lives which were brought together really just by this coincidence. Yeah. They did happen to live in the square, and as you said, it sort of could have been other people, but the fact that it was them and putting them together and thinking about them alongside each other, the resonances and the differences and the sort of eerie similarities, I think resonated a lot as I was researching and writing about them. And which was fortifying, and a reminding that there are no answers or there's no one way to answer those questions, and they all had different sort of privileges, and they had different difficulties, and some of them intersected, and so none of them are exactly role models, but
no.
Well, they are.
But a creative act anyway.
Yeah.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Now, Francesca, obviously quite soon we're going to be turning the whole bookshop into one of Eileen Power's kitchen dances.
Yeah, we've got a morning dress.
We've got the morning dress
as
ready.
The invitation.
But I think before that, maybe people would like to ask some questions.
I just wondered whether you've used the word echoes during the course of conversation this evening, whether some of those echoes were revelatory when you were actually engaged in the research. So somebody like John Cornus, were you expecting him to appear in two of those women's lives? It must have been really exciting when you came across that.
Yeah, it was. I think that was the moment where I think I realised that this sort of weird conglomeration of coincidences could be a book, was when I realised that the same man had written incredibly insulting novels about two of these women. he's a really strange character. And then he pops up again because he was a Russian translator who overlapped with Joan Harrison, weirdly. But yeah, John Cornus was a sort of a failed imagist poet who encountered HD. He was actually engaged to Arabella, the upstairs lodger, and he went away to Russia and sort of asked HD to look after Arabella. And when he came back, she was kind of having an affair with HD's husband, and he entirely blamed HD. I mean, of all the people he could have blamed for that situation, he alighted on it being HD's fault and wrote this novel, which I think the Spectator reviewer said that it had the most unpleasant heroine in all of literature, and HD was pretty upset. But then a few years later, he had a relationship with Dorothy Sayers. I never quite worked out how they met, because he had lived in Mecklenburg Square as well. He'd lived right at the top and given Arabella his room, and I don't know whether they met there or through the landlady who Sayers was on quite good terms with or what, but through the year that she spent in the square when she was trying to start writing her own first novel, she was also grappling with this relationship with this older male writer who did not think crime fiction was a good pursuit, and who really, I think, ground her down. And it wasn't until much later, when she'd had some success and had reflected on these years, that she was able to write this amazing series of letters back to him where she really told him how hard he had made things for her.
Good.
But then he wrote a horrible book about her, and she also wrote a book about a detective novel where a character with a lot of resemblances to him gets murdered by Harriet.
Yes. Yes. So, being a crime writer has distinct benefits in that. Yes. And she said when she moved to the square, that's all I want, to be left alone. Do you get that?
Yeah. But that was a total surprise, and there were other surprises, I think. It was always exciting. When there was another moment when I I saw that Eileen Power had Dorothy Sayers in her address book, and I sort of, you know, wondered what had happened there. And then I went to Wheaton College in Illinois to see the Dorothy Sayers archive, and I found this letter, or a couple of letters, and it was clear that they'd met at a party and started talking about books. You can imagine them just sort of, you know, no small talk, it's just the sort of meeting of minds. And Eileen Power wrote to Sayers and was enclosing her own copy of a book, which she said, this seems exactly what you want. And then she says at the end, it was such a pleasure to meet you, which I thought was sort of gave me goosebumps, as this realization that, you know, that these women themselves, when they did cross paths, they sensed this, you know, this commonality, and that was very moving.
Thank you so much for this talk and for talking so much about HD. I did my MA dissertation, I recently finished, on HD's Helen in Egypt, so it's cool to be in a room with someone who knows what that is. But I was looking at, in Helen in Egypt, HD's relationship to her American and sort of British national identities. And a lot of the work that's been done on that wants to peg HD sort of as an American, using her early autobiographical prose that talks about her time in Pennsylvania and these things like that. And so I think it's really interesting that you are looking at this particular place that she lived in, London, that she revisits over and over and over again, and sort of establishing who she is. And so I was wondering if in your research you kind of came across this idea of her being rooted in this very particular physical space in Britain as connected to how she saw herself connected to the nation of Britain at all, or if it influenced a sense of her as a citizen of, as a British citizen.
Interesting. I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, I think she, in this year, she felt so ambivalent about her relationship to America, I guess, because I don't think she really went back to America after she left it, did she ever even? And I think she felt like an outsider in Britain, and she writes quite a lot about that sense of people being kind of suspicious of her, especially given America's kind of position in the war. And I think she spent a lot of time in Europe after this period, and she, and I think a lot of these women kind of considered themselves European in lots of ways, or, you know, didn't feel particularly tied to a national identity with all of the kind of imperial and sort of patriarchal connotations. I think that she, you know, Wolfe in Three Guineas says, you know, as a woman, I have no country, my country's the whole world. And I think that was something that kind of resonated when I thought about all of them. But I'd like to think more about it.
It's really intriguing that they can all live in this absolutely central London square and yet be outside, and yet be cultivating this idea of themselves as outsiders.
Yeah, but I guess also Bloomsbury was so international at that time. I mean, it was so close to the railway stations, which had opened up quite recently, and so it did feel like it was a place of connection. And because of the houses being divided up into boarding houses and hotels, and being so close to the universities, there were students, and, you know, it was a kind of a hub. It was, so if you wanted to live a life where you might, you know, bump into, you know, Russians or Indians or, you know, Chinese, then that Bloomsbury was a place where that could happen. And I loved reading kind of memoirs and novels about Bloomsbury and by more widely for that research, and came across, you know, there are so many interesting figures. I mean, there's this guy Mulk Rajanand, whose kind of autobiography is called Conversations in Bloomsbury, and he concludes by saying something like, Bloomsbury is so much wider than Virginia Woolf's drawing room. And who is?
I'm up to the Dorothy Alsayers chapter of your book, and I'm finding it just super interesting. And one of the really interesting things for me is that there are loads of really famous names in this book that are the smaller characters, and we see these really huge figures through the eyes of these five women. We see Ezra Pound or D.H. Lawrence, but only through the lens of how HD would have seen them and the impact they have on her career. And obviously Pound as an editor to HD is a much more ambivalent figure than Pound as an editor to Eliot, for example. We see London the same. We see London through the lens of this one square. And I wonder if taking that approach to it, if you, if your opinion or your view of any of these famous people or even of this time period changed by seeing it through the eyes of your subjects.
Yeah, I mean, I think with HD in particular, it was important to see these yeah, these like mammoth characters like Ezra Pound through her eyes, because she kind of spent her life avoiding being seen through their eyes. I mean, Pound was the one who gave her these initials, HD, and sort of named her, and he sent her poems to this big influential magazine under that name, and she was kind of flattered and excited, but also never really liked that name, and she was sort of stuck with it, and names were so important for HD.
You didn't really want to be a wood dryad either.
No, she didn't really like that either. Although she didn't really like the surname Doolittle either, so it was sort of, she all of the novels that she wrote through her life, she gave different pseudonyms to, and she thought a lot about the implications of naming. So I think she was always kind of stepping out of the shadow of people like Pound. And I guess, yeah, in terms of how we would still see sort of modernist history, it felt important that, you know, they were part of her story, but they are secondary characters. And it's, I guess, and with London as well, which is nice that you mentioned, it's kind of, I think, seeing a different London is something that Wolfe writes about a lot. I mean, I sort of opened the book with this statue, which you can still see just at the top of Guild Place, which was Wolfe's favourite statue in London. And it's just this woman kneeling down, and there's no kind of sign. She doesn't have a name, although she does if you look it up. Well, still, she's just the woman of Samaria. And Wolfe said that, you know, she got so much more out of that statue than she did out of all of the, you know, statues of old men outside Parliament. And it's a kind of an emblem for the different kind of history, I think, that she and Power and Harrison are all looking to write, you know, history that isn't just public deeds of, you know, great men of empire, but it might just be, you know, a woman on her own kneeling.
It might even be the landlady or the cook.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.